to be your discussant today. And just to echo my word, to the chorus, I suppose, to add to the refrain, this is a wonderful document of what happened through those turbulent years, where you reflect very deeply and very cautiously at times, but we get your vantage point of what you were seeing, and more importantly, what you were feeling at certain times. And of course, at the back, you reflect on what it is to lead a university of the stature of Cape Town through those kind of times. So thank you for the book. Thank you for being brave. Thank you for being courageous. So perhaps let me start with the boring questions and get them out of the way first. Why did you write the book?
Because everyone said you better write a book. during the turbulent times, it wasn't possible, I felt, to tell my side of the story. And the story was being told largely by the press. It was being told significantly by the students who controlled the social media, and we didn't know how to do social media, frankly. And it was often impossible to provide insights into our decisions because it wouldn't have been strategic. In an adversarial situation, revealing your strategy doesn't necessarily help. So, for example, at any point, the reason for continuing negotiations another week or two, or closing the university or not, would not have been possible to talk about that. And so I wanted to contribute to the archive of this period. I think this was a critical period in the history of higher education in South Africa, and in fact in the world, it turns out, but started here. And there will be many people who will write about it, and I felt it was important to give an insider's view and to give my view, or clearly recognizing that it's a partisan view. So one purpose was to help record a history of a very important period, a watershed period. The second was to share my personal experience being in the eye of the storm, and in that sense it's a memoir, and the experience... The family's experience, the costs, and also the highs of that. A third purpose was, as I was to share my own trajectory, my own journey of understanding, that helped me understand why Black students and staff were experiencing UCT in the way that they did, why they felt alienated, why they felt that they didn't belong, why they felt that the institutional culture was so was hostile to them and colonial, as they put it. And it was a journey which, and in that sense, the book, that part of the book or that theme is particularly directed at white audiences, white readership, but not just in South Africa, because these are issues that are prevalent in the American universities, the British universities, and people dealing with Black Lives Matter, with identitarian politics all over. And for many of us who grew up in these universities, the universities were oases of freedom during apartheid. We were proud of the fact that they were the sites of struggle against apartheid, and that they created places where Black students could come and get a good education in spite of the apartheid system. And so I think many of us were taken aback when we discovered that Black students didn't see it the same way, or Black alumni didn't see it the same way, and that their experience was that they just wanted, they appreciated they'd got a good education, which they wouldn't otherwise have had, but they just wanted to be out of UCT and to forget it. And when I came to UCT and started meeting with alumni, discovered that they were mostly white alumni that were active, and that the Black alumni didn't really want to have much to do with UCT, and trying to find out why, I realized they were very bitter, and that hadn't been addressed and hadn't been resolved. And I needed to understand that. And it surprised me that that continued into the post-apartheid period. And so this discovery of my own, and I think other white people's, blind spots about how Black people experienced the institution was important for me, and I wanted to share that with a wider audience.
And in fact, to share that with a story of one particular student who was probably top of her class in Limpopo, I think is the province, managed to get enrolled at UCT, at some point put her hand up to ask a question, and because the lecturer could not understand her, that was it. She never asked another question for the rest of that year, at the very least.
And that's right. And so that was about accent and familiarity with English. So the fact that so many of our students have never been taught by a first language English teacher throughout their schooling and find the accents difficult, they can't take notes fast enough, they feel embarrassed to ask for help because they never had to have help before. They were the top of their class in Taung, this particular young woman came from. And she comes to UC and she fails her first class test. So the reaction to all of that, she also sees that white students are on first name terms with their professors and lecturers because it's a very familiar social milieu. They mix with them at Sunday lunches at their parents' home, whereas the black students have this huge social distance. They've never met, they've never eaten. I'm generalizing, but I'm talking about the majority who come from townships and rural areas. They've never shared a meal with a white person, and the cultural distance, the class distance is huge. And so what they observe is this familiarity and what looks like favoritism to them,
yeah,
from a white lecturer or a white professor to white students, and they're on the margins. And then when they start failing because they haven't been able to ask for help, they despair and they go into a tailspin. So that trajectory I wanted to share with white, particularly with white audiences. Black readers clearly don't need to be told that. And then lastly, many of the issues that were raised by the students or that came up throughout my term are enduring issues, controversies in the world of academia. Issues about what is academic freedom and what are the limits to it. What are the limits to legitimate protest? Protest can often be unlawful. That's what civil disobedience process by definition is. It is breaking the law. And clearly we don't simply dismiss all civil disobedience protest as unacceptable. In fact, it's driven much of the human rights struggles around the world. So if it's not simply lawfulness or unlawfulness that defines the limits of protest, then what is it? When does it become violent? When does it cross a line? And that was an issue we had to deal with often. So that's one of the issues: academic freedom, freedom of press, freedom of artistic expression, and the freedom, the rights of sculptors, in the case of the Sarah Bartman sculpture, to have their artworks displayed the way they intended, in spite of how an audience might respond to that and feel grossly offended or exploited. The issues of coloniality and decoloniality, of identity. So these are issues which are being grappled with, taking down statues, changing names of buildings. These are issues that have been grappled with by universities across the world. And much of that started at UCT and has spread, you know, in Bristol University, Edward Colston, the slave trader, funded and endowed the university. His statue 2 years ago was pulled off its pedestal and thrown in the Bristol Canal. The statues of the Confederacy generals that are littered, I use the word littered intentionally, littered all over the universities of the southern states are being removed one by one. And that was almost unthinkable prior to Rhodes must fall. So it has huge significance, and the book attempts to unpack many of those debates and illustrate them.
You also go to incredible detail in retelling, reflecting, documenting, as you say, what you were seeing and what you were witnessing. Were you keeping a diary throughout? Were you going home every night and going, oh my word, that was a traumatic day, and write this down?
My diary, my notes were very intermittent and very patchy. Deborah, my wife, who's here, did keep a diary, and I've drawn heavily on that for as a memory aid. But actually, the process of writing was traumatic in a way, precisely because I didn't remember the detail. And what I had to do was to go back and reread. Fortunately, for better or worse, this was covered extensively in the press. It was covered on TV. Every student had a camera and photographed the protests, and they are still there on YouTube and on they were live streamed at the time, but they'd been recorded on various websites. And so I spent a lot of time refreshing my memory by going through those public records. And that was traumatic, actually. And it was interesting because I think I experienced the stress and the trauma more while writing and reviewing those than I remember experiencing them in the moment. And so, and that I probably blocked a lot of that, which made it more difficult to recover, because I wasn't just drawing on memory. Therefore, I was needing to find these from other sources. And it was a sort of strange, almost out-of-body experience reviewing it, because it didn't seem, I was asking myself, was I really there? Did that really happen? It almost, there wasn't a visual record. I wouldn't be sure that it had happened as it did. So I suppose that tells us something about how people deal, cope in very stressed situations, as people do in situations of war, for example, where you have adrenaline and you have other protection mechanisms and you have a thick skin which get you through and probably suppress memories. And then at a later time, if you have occasion to revisit them, the anxiety or the stress may surface there. So writing the book was hard, and that's partly why it did take 4 years or so to do.
When did you start writing it?
I finished my term of office, my 10 years, in the middle of 2018, and I started writing in the middle of 2019.
Yeah. And out of interest, when you were reviewing the footage, then previously live stream but now recorded material, did you ever go, why did I do that? Or I would have reacted differently now, 4 years into reflecting, than what I did on that day in 2016?
No, not really. There are a few things I would, in reflecting on that time, that we would do differently, but not related to those episodes of protest or crowd management or engagement with students or protesters. I can come back to that, but what I could see was what people used to say to me, which I didn't really understand at the time, which was that I seemed to be unflappable and calm, and I was. I mean, when you look at the video, I think I am, and that surprises me as well. So it's more that I'm surprised. Wow, good on you, Max. Hey, will you be able to do that again? I'm not sure. The thing that I would probably do differently primarily relates to the thing I think we failed at. That's putting aside too strongly. But the thing we didn't do well was communications, and I think it's partly that we just had not as an older generation management team. We did not understand, and probably still do not understand, the world of social media. And this was the protests at UCT were an extension in a way of the Arab Spring revolutions, which had been fueled and successful in part because of the way that protesters were able to use social media, and the authorities in charge were unable to respond to that. And although it was already 4 years after the Arab Spring, we also hadn't really honed the tools. So students were putting material up onto social media and live streaming material, whereas we had a system still of, you know, if there was going to be it was going to be through press releases, we would call press conferences. This press statement would go through several levels of approval to be sure that it said exactly what we wanted to say. I'm quite OCD, and I wouldn't let anyone release anything in my name that I hadn't seen, and if I was just really busy, then it might have to wait a day until I could sign off on it, which frustrated the comms department.
And what would happen in the interim is that whatever is shared on social media, which sometimes was a mistruth, or at least a misrepresentation of what was happening, that would be the narrative that everybody would be discussing on radio, reflecting on television news channels and newspapers, and we won't dwell on independent newspapers, but there was a target on you, and therefore often misinformation was being reported on the front pages sometimes of the newspapers, and you guys were slow to respond and say, actually, this is what it is.
Yeah, and I mean, even our own staff and the parents of our students were going to the students' social media pages to get their news, because they could get it quickly. We shot ourselves in the foot many times as a result. So one of the lessons I hope that comes out of the book for leaders managing crises is you have to prepare for that in advance. You can't start learning that when the crisis hits.
Let's talk about the impact on your family, because there's Max, who was unflappable whenever we saw him on news channels, but you have a beautiful wife who had given, to some extent, her life up, which was very successful in Johannesburg, to move to Cape Town because you've been given this wonderful opportunity, was setting up her own space and was being affected negatively. Your children, what impact did that period have on your family?
I mean, they should speak for themselves, but I'm not going to give them a chance. my daughter had graduated already, and she graduated in 2014, so before the process hit. But she was an SRC vice president at UCT, and so there had been a period before when we had a sparring relationship, because SRCs have to do that. But I think she was much less affected. My son was at UCT during the time, and I think for him it was tough, very tough, because he was politically closely aligned to the protesters, but to those issues, to making higher education more affordable, to understanding the challenges that students from disadvantaged backgrounds faced, and he would have been, you know, a protest leader. He was arrested, in fact, at the parliament protests as well, because he was there at the barricades with other students. But he also had an inside, he had an understanding from being in the household. He didn't live with us, but from being in the household, of my perspective and of management's perspective, and it was impossible for him to, and he didn't want to be, and I didn't want him to be my messenger or my ambassador in that crowd. So he had to just stay silent or hear, but not participate more actively. And for Deborah, I think the key thing that happened was that, having been a professor, far more senior, I've never been a full professor, she's a much more senior academic and better academic than I've ever been. And she had creative.
It's objectively
verifiable. She came to UCT, set up an institute, but when the protest broke, she became the vice chancellor's wife.
Yeah.
Instead of being an independent academic, and as the vice chancellor's wife, from having been completely included in the academic circles, the seminars, the departmental activities, there was now a sort of concern that criticism of me in her presence would become pillow talk. And one of our adversaries, I don't remember if I put this in the book or if the editor cut it out, because the editor cut out 40% of the book. But one of the anecdotes was, we had dinner with someone, and Deborah did not always participate in things that were entirely social, where she wasn't necessarily, where it wasn't, you know, necessary. She participated in lots and lots. But we had one engagement with someone who was very critical of me, and I was trying to get to understand his point of view. And for some reason, he thought that Deborah ought to have been at the dinner. And he wrote an article in the newspaper the next day to talk about this, and he said, Lady Macbeth didn't attend. She, no doubt, influences, pulls the strings from behind the scenes. So, you know, unnecessary jibes, which clearly have an impact.
In fact, you write about how during that time, people you'd known for a long time, people you respected, people who to some extent were confidants and people you referred to whenever you needed to make decisions, suddenly were sitting on the other side and they were judging you. Instead of, they have access to you, coming to you and say, Max, let's talk about what's happening.
Yeah, on some specific issues. So there were issues which reasonable people can disagree about, and they did. And people have said, how do you feel when the students called you racist, or when you said you were anti-transformation or colonialist? If it was coming from students, I felt my skin was thick enough to let that wash over me. I know my values, I know my own history, I don't feel insecure about that, and I understand that they're often targeting the office rather than me personally. It's because I represent the organization. The arrows that stung were the arrows that came from people who I generally think are allies and share the values I have, and who had been in the trenches together in the pre-94 period. And when they criticized me, it was certainly cause to pause and to spend a lot of time thinking about whether I was doing the right thing, whether we, it's always an executive decision, whether we were doing the right thing or getting it wrong. And probably the time, the two incidents, so most of the time we were on the same side and I valued their support. But the two episodes where there was most tension was firstly the disinvitation of Fleming Rose, the person who we invited to give the Academic Freedom Lecture. Well, the Academic Freedom Committee invited him to give the Academic Freedom Lecture, and I decided to withdraw that invitation. And it was something that I deeply regretted having to do, but I felt we had to do it because of the consequences for violence on the campus if we didn't do that. And it was a clear acknowledgement that we were unable to protect academic freedom on the campus in this context. But I was hammered by the liberal left for that decision. And I felt that they didn't understand the issues well enough, and we had to make that decision, and they think they understood it well and we should have persisted. And the other decision was around the artworks, and the Sara Bartman sculpture is a case in point, where it was a contested space with students one day covering the sculpture up. I think most of you probably know or are familiar with the sculpture. It's this sculpture of almost naked sculpture of Sara Bartman, and for many students, particularly black women students, they felt that this was a repeat of her of the exploitation, the sexual exploitation she'd experienced as a freak show in Paris, where she was on display with her large buttocks and genitalia, and here she was also naked, large buttocks, genitalia on display in the library with people walking past on a daily basis, not really knowing who she was or her history, but ogling this spectacle. And they felt this was humiliating for them, and they felt it was the equivalent of putting pin-up pictures on your wall, centerfold pin-up. Does anyone remember what centerfold was? But anyway, and so there was this very strong lobby that covers was covering her, and then other people who were taking off the covers, and the sculpture was at risk of being damaged in the process as well, and we had to deal with this. My decision, the team's decision, a committee called the Works of Art Committee, decided that it should remain covered. And that unleashed a ton of criticism that we were against the freedom of expression and censorship and all that. And it came from people who, at all other times, I'm strongly aligned with politically. So those were the tough experiences from comrades.
I spent a lot of time focusing on how it's impacted on you and your family, because in the book, while you reflect on that, you don't dwell on it. You're more generous. You're more wanting to reflect on how the process and the time impacted not only the university but the general discourse in South Africa and abroad, which was very kind of you. But it is important to note that this had an impact on you personally, and that it had an impact on your family as well.
May I just remind people, that one of the anecdotes which I think captures that is when we had protests outside the gates of our residence, which happened quite frequently. And at one point we thought that it could turn into an arson attack, and we packed all our stuff into our precious things, the photo albums and personal things, into suitcases to take them and deposit them at some friends of ours, because we thought we might have to leave the house in a hurry. And that's another way in which it impacted on family and family life.
We weren't going to terrible detail in terms of the incidents, because one, many of us lived through it, and two, it's documented beautifully in the book, so please buy it, and he's going to autograph it for you, and you can read through the detail. But perhaps to take the broad strokes, and to start with the statue, it was a bold statement. Some would argue it was a necessary statement that was made by the student, and your reflections, once again, 4 years later, on processes followed by the university, the leadership that you demonstrated, and ultimately the decision that was taken.
I think you said it all. what can I add? So, one of the things I reflect on is, why didn't it happen many years before? Because the statue has been controversial since the 1940s. When Afrikaans students saw this as the Cecil Rhodes they blamed for the Anglo-Boer War, the South African War, he was the person who they blamed for the concentration camps in which many Afrikaan women and children died, and so for them, the statue of Rhodes was already a huge problem. In the 1970s and 80s, left-wing students saw Rhodes and mining capital as the real cause of discrimination and inequality and apartheid. In fact, apartheid was called racial capitalism. And so they used to daub the statue with paint and protest on it. After 1994, students of all colours protested against the colonialism that Rhodes represented. So why did it take till 2015 before we actually took it down? And I think I can't really speak for the other vice chancellors before me, but for me, I was already concerned about it from the start of my term, and in the year before the protest, I had committed the university to reviewing its policy on statues, on symbols, on names of buildings, and we started that process. Crane City University. Yeah. It was the Deputy Vice Chancellor in charge of that, and he started the process of this review. But I think we felt that we would not get a majority of people, of students, of staff. We were sensitive to the feelings of alumni who feel very fondly and nostalgically to the name of Jameson Hall, the Jameson Plaza, and the statue. Donors, and it would be very divisive. We wouldn't get the support, and it would end up staying if we pushed it before it was ready. And so the protest changed that, because and tipped the balance and changed the balance of costs and benefits. Following the protest, the single protest, Chimani's protest, In the week that followed, there was this outpouring of support for removing the statue from thousands of students, black and white. Not yet from the majority of staff. And my judgment in the beginning was that the Senate, which guides this sort of policy, would have been at least divided 50-50, and most would not have supported removing the statue. They might have supported some other intervention. And even government officials, the president and others, the Minister of Higher Education, Vladen Zamandi, said the statue should not be removed because the ANC policy had been that in recognition of the multiple heritages and cultures in the country, part of the reconciliation strategy was to recognize and not remove, not erase those histories. So it was by no means clear that we would have had a majority or enough support to remove it. But the protest unleashed a much larger protest. It signalled that there probably was support. And my concern was to ensure that we created a greater consensus rather than simply a majority, let's say, of 55% against 45%, where the majority then determined what should happen. And it might well have gone the other way, to keep the statue. And through the discussions and through the articles that were then written about Rhodes and people using social media to highlight things Rhodes had done, which reached audiences
that hadn't been reached before, a consensus grew, a remarkable consensus grew, that the statue should be removed. I did not think it should be removed from the campus altogether, and I didn't want to accept amendments in the discussion that removed them, but there was a vote, and the votes decided that it should be removed. But it's in a garage somewhere, hiding. And you'll see this little anecdote that someone wanted to buy it for a theme park in Texas of rogue statues. It's a very interesting story. This chap has been collecting statues of Saddam Hussein and the Eastern Bloc dictators from Ukraine and from Poland. And he wanted one of Rhodes in particular because his theme park started when he observed the Rhodes statue in what was then Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, being taken down. So he really wanted this statue. He was willing to pay a lot of money. But we decided that there'll come a time when the statue will probably be on display in a gallery or in a museum or something, when it can be curated properly, when it can be a point of educational activity to remind people who he was, what he did, what his strengths were, what his weaknesses were, and about, you know, colonialism and capitalism in the formation of the country. So he's around and no doubt will make an appearance one day.
Around on campus.
No, I'm not telling you.
Perhaps to extend that then to, and this happened a little bit later in the process, but the one of the heartbreaking moments for me was watching priceless art being burnt down and destroyed. Because if nothing else, you're taking away the opportunity for engagement, the opportunity for talking through some of the sensitivities and getting to a consensus, a social cohesion, whatever the case may be. The act of in a second destroying what is cultural heritage, positively or not, for me was heartbreaking. Talk to us about the process around the artworks.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking and devastating for me, and devastating for the reputation of the university, because the image of burning art is close to the image of burning books, and people sort of linked it to things like ISIS burning global cultural heritage, destroying global cultural heritage. And, you know, people around the world thought, how can this be happening at UCT? And I shared that. And in fact, it was one of the key concerns during the Rhodes statue debate that it shouldn't be simply pulled down. We had to provide guards 24/7 because we thought that someone would come with a truck and a chain in the middle of the night and pull it over. And we had to ironically protect it while we were debating its removal. You know, so what is there to say? I can't defend, and I don't try to defend the protesters' actions. I think that there was an upwelling of anger and frustration, which was related to the experience of art in the universe, on the university's walls. The fact that black students, or all students, of course, would walk down the passages of the universities. And they were, and what they would see was the portraits and photographs of deans, chancellors, vice chancellors, heads of departments, committees, student executive committees of sports clubs, faculty committees, residence committees, and they were almost all white. Not surprisingly, because they went back 100 years, and for many of those years they were only whites, or almost only whites on campus. But even in more recent times, the senior staff of the university have been largely white, and so their experience of what the university is saying to them, or reflecting back to them, is that this is not their space, and this is not where they belong, and this is and that excellence has a colour, leadership and excellence has a colour, and the colour is white, and the frustration then was when it burst out, was not, you know, they didn't know what they were burning. As everyone knows, five of the paintings that were burnt paintings done by our first black African fine arts master's degree student, and they were paintings of the lamp of academic freedom and Nelson Mandela getting his honorary degree at UCT. So there wasn't any thought that went into it. It was a random rage, but I think triggered by the sense that the art took no account, and the photographs took no account of the changing demography and the need to be a more inclusive space. So it's not defensible. It was very damaging for the institution and for all of us. But it was also, and it led then with our reaction. The Works of Art Committee said the first thing we have to do is to protect the rest of the art, and because the UCT has never had an art gallery, and it actually always prided itself on the fact that it didn't have an art gallery, because it meant that these beautiful artworks were always on display in public spaces, in the libraries, in the residences, in the foyers, outside lecture theatres. But of course that comes now, it became clear, that it comes with a cost, that it's vulnerable and it's almost impossible to protect. And so our first task was to identify the works that we thought might be controversial, that people might react to, and either remove them or cover them as a way of protecting them. Because that's our first duty. And then to rethink our curatorial policies so that when they go back up on display, they go up in a display that is more balanced, more inclusive, or has context included in it, explanation, or in a gallery where people can choose to confront a work of art or not, particularly if they find it offensive, like the Sarah Bartman sculpture. And I think I think we've made great progress in that regard, and I noticed that universities or institutions all over the world have adopted similar kinds of policies.
One of the consequences of the university poorly communicating what the university was doing is that the perception that was enjoyed on social media and on some of the traditional media spaces was that you were letting the students get away with murder, that you were conceding to too many of the demands, that you were not holding them accountable for their actions enough. And what comes through strongly in the book is the process of the university and you were following to actually hold them to account.
Yeah, so the holding to account is particularly paradoxical, because what many people didn't realize, and as you say, that reflects our poor communication, is that after the night of serious violence, which was one night in February 2016, when the paintings were burnt, a bus was burnt, a research bucky was burnt, and my office was firebombed. That night of trauma and arson, which was associated with what was called the Shackville protest, led immediately to an interdict and to 12 students being excluded from the campus, to disciplinary cases, which resulted in several of them being expelled, several being rusticated, which means they were removed for the rest of the year, couldn't continue that year, and others being disciplined in other ways, community service, etc. And that punishment, that sanction, then became the subject of much of the protest for the rest of the year. And the campaign was called Bring Back Al Qaeda's, hashtag Bring Back Al Qaeda's. If we had agreed to doing that in June, when that campaign, so the disciplinary cases took a little while to come to fruition, and the violence was in February, but by June all the disciplinary cases almost were concluded and students had been expelled, and that's when the Bring Back Al Qaeda's campaign started. If we had conceded to that, we would have had a largely peaceful year for the rest of the year. It was precisely because we wouldn't agree to that and we wouldn't grant the amnesties that were being demanded that the protests continued and the flames continued or reoccurred in the latter part of the year. And it was part of the final agreement when we came up with this idea of clemency, and the book describes how we differentiated the idea of amnesty and clemency and what the conditions were that students had to sign in order to get that. But it was only at that point, and we needed to compromise on that. We compromised on that so that 20,000 students could write their exams, and we decided that was a compromise. But it wasn't through not holding the students accountable for that period. So that's the one part of the theme. A separate theme we were accused of was continuing the negotiations indefinitely and closing the university while we were doing that, instead of taking a firm line with peace and security to say we're not going to negotiate, this is how it's going to be, and we will force it. And what I try to explain in the book is our strategy. We think we faced an opposition which we couldn't easily defeat. And one example of that would be the way that the protesters would disrupt the residences. So this was all happening in October 2016. Students are preparing for exams which should have started in the last week of October. Most of these students, and especially black students and disadvantaged students, are in residences in the university. There's 6,000 to 7,000 students in residences. And what protesters would do, and only needs a few people to do this, is they discovered, or they knew, that if you spray an aerosol into the fire alarm in each room has a fire alarm, it triggers the fire alarm. And so at 11 o'clock at night, and then again at 2 o'clock in the morning, and then at 4 o'clock in the morning, someone would trigger a fire alarm somewhere in the residence. The alarm would go off. All the students have to be evacuated from the residence. You have to go and see if there really a fire, and then they can be let back in. This is while they're trying to study for exams. And we found that there was almost nothing we could do to counter this, because our systems didn't allow us to identify the precise room. It only allowed us to identify a wing and a floor of the building. It would come from different places at different times in the night. And we then disabled the fire alarms to deal with this. And of course, they started lighting fires. Or heaters would be left on and then would, you know, trigger the alarms. And then so we had to have other systems of fire marshals on 24/7 in the residences. But even if you can manage that, students can't study and concentrate and be in a calm environment to write the exams peacefully. So we needed to negotiate, and we realized that this large protest group, which was perhaps 2,000 to 4,000 students, actually comprised many different groups who felt marginalized for one reason or another. Students with mental health challenges, students with disability, the trans collective, students who were transitioning or had transitioned, the LGBTI group, black students. And there was one group, a core group, which was, I will call them a Fanonist group, because they espoused a view of Fanon, which I don't think is an accurate rendition of Franz Fanon's philosophy, but a view that the transformation, the transition in South Africa, the shift from a colonial system to a post-colonial system had never been achieved, and the reason it hadn't been achieved was because there hadn't been violence. Fanon at some point expressed a view that the colonized needed to destroy the system that they had inherited before being able to rebuild it. And so there was a group that felt that they had to actually destroy the university and the system more widely for its own sake. The violence and the destruction was not a means to another end, it was the end in itself. That group would never have been satisfied by any concessions or any agreements, but it was a very small group. What we had to do was to cleave off the larger groups that had reasonable demands and were aggrieved for things that we could do something about. Students who had been excluded because they didn't have enough money, or they couldn't pay off their bank loans, or students who felt that their disability was not being catered for and they couldn't cope at university because we weren't addressing it. Or students who felt that the gendered toilets meant that when they needed to go to the toilet, they couldn't go anywhere because they were transgender or a third gender. So, and we could address those things. Those were not unreasonable demands. We could listen to them and hear them. And over the 4 weeks of negotiations, we did. And as a result, we were left with a small group that we thought we could manage either through coercive means, through security and police, or, as it turned out, they could see that they were not going to be able to shut the university any longer, they were not going to be able to disrupt the exams, and they signed an agreement which said they agreed not to. And that ended up, we ended up with an exam session at the end of 2016, which was completely peaceful. We could remove the police from campus, and I think everyone who wrote had a much better experience as a result.
Two last broad topics. The one is, you spoke about decolonization as a project. Your reflections now on that aspect of the Fordist movement?
On decolonization. That's one of those terms that can mean everything and nothing, and many people will give it even contradictory meanings. I think that it can be applied to many different aspects of the university environment, and in many respects. So the institutional culture that I've described, and institutional culture which was very much a culture of whiteness in many respects, I think has been challenged and is substantially changed, and changed for the better. And I think that battle has been fought and won in a way, and that transformation will proceed much more quickly as a result. Because the blind spots that I described and the resistance, many people not appreciating what was needed in changing the institutional culture, I think that's no longer an issue, no longer a debate. So at one level, decolonizing the culture is happening and will continue and is successful. It moved in another area. Decolonizing curricula is a much more complex complex issue. I believe that many academics were for 2 or 3 decades have been addressing this in one way or another, and more or less successfully. The literatures and the curricula of the English department or the philosophy or various departments have already been taking account of the need to diversify authors, diversify literatures, diversify sources of authority, to move away from a purely Anglo-American or Eurocentric focus. That's been accelerated, and I think it's been taken much more seriously. To give you an example out of my own field, which is medicine and health.
Sorry.
When I was a medical student, and until relatively recently, if we had a patient who came into the wards suffering, say, from TB, and that patient had a string around his wrist, which was a sign that they'd recently been to Sangoma, it would not be uncommon for the consultant to say to the student doctors around, look at this superstitious attitude. Instead of coming straight to the healthcare service and treating the TB early, this patient has been going to Sangoma for the last 3 or 4 months, believing that the ancestors would be able to cure the TB, and now when it's too late to be properly cured, it's pitched up at our hospital, at a Western hospital. Now, that sort of attitude is common. It was expressed without any sense of how Eurocentric it was, and how black students in that doctor trainee group might respond, given that they themselves have belief systems which valorize the ancestors and which valorize the role of Sangoma. So it just completely ignored that and trampled on it in a way, dismissed it as superstitious. It's no more superstitious or unbelievable than praying to God or to Jesus for salvation when you've got TB. But it was dismissed as being primitive. And then, of course, it dismissed the patient's views. And instead of creating an environment where a patient could confide in what traditional medicines and mutis they may have taken in order to help a team of healers cure them, the patients would suppress that and make it in secret. This is all about about recognizing that we are a multicultural society, that the predominant authority of Western medicine has to be questioned. It's not that Western medicine is wrong, but that we've got to be more sensitive and open to a variety of belief systems. So I think that's happening, and it's happening better in some places than in others, and there's still a long way to go. But that all of that is part of the consequence of he struggles to transform the university.
One of my joys every year is to host the higher education conference hosted by PwC. And it's primarily financial directors and people working with money, the being companies of various universities. And UCT came under a lot of flack when you guys went ahead with the decision to insource services, because many of the universities just couldn't afford it. They literally just could not afford a situation where they would sort of take in outsourced service and put it into their resources. Your reflections on that decision by the university?
Well, I think it's the right decision, although I think it was the right decision at this time. There's a whole chapter devoted to the debate not specific to UCT, but about outsourcing and insourcing. Why companies outsource, why that often makes sense, why in the South African environment that's been really, in my view, detrimental to workers because it leads to hyper-exploitation, and why we therefore decided to insource. To reverse the outsourcing. It is more expensive. It's more expensive because outsourcing leads to the suppression of wages to very low levels, and we have to make a choice about whether we have a more unequal society and more unequal institution, income inequality institution, or whether we allocate our resources differently. And so there will be less money for research. There will be less money for teaching. I had hoped that the other staff of the university, I had misread the mood, because the insourcing cost UCT as well, and it cost us, we had to increase the salaries by about 30% or 40% in order to bring those workers in, and that was going to cost us about 2 to 3% of our total wage bill extra from what we were spending beforehand. I had thought that the support for insourcing from academics and support staff was such that they would accept a reduced increase in their annual salaries in order to pay for that. Instead of going CPI plus 1%, I proposed CPI minus 1% increases. The academic staff, to their credit, accepted that. The majority of staff, which is not academic in university, believe it or not, two-thirds are not academic, rejected that, and I decided that it wasn't then fair to make the academic staff bear the burden, so it wasn't implemented. But we then went, that contributed to the following year an attrition strategy where we had to save 120 million out of our budget on a recurrent basis to pay for this, one of the things we had to pay for. So in some ways it's a choice you make, but I do accept that it was easier for UCT to make that decision because it is a wealthier university. It has more students who can afford all the fees than other universities do. It doesn't have quite as heavy a burden of financial aid to other students. And the question then is, were the other universities, should one take adopt a strategy which says unless all universities can insource, none should do so? And there are some universities that thought that we should do. They said to me, you know, if UCT insources, the rest of us aren't going to be able to resist that, and you're putting us in a situation where you're going to kill us. And we took the view that that it would be better if we could do something jointly, but ultimately, if we couldn't, we would do what we had to do. And in the end, some universities did insource and others didn't. So it put pressure on them, but they've done what they felt they had to do.
In the concluding chapter of your book, you write, whatever it is, I'm mostly grateful for it. For struggling a decent night's sleep, suppressing anxiety, and all of that. It enabled me to fulfill what I thought was expected of a leader in a time of crisis, namely to be seen to be strong, unfazed by the setbacks, willing to listen, consistent, and likely to walk away from facing whatever came. And I think you were an exemplary demonstration of that during a time when everybody was looking to you for that leadership, regardless of where they fell on the spectrum. and what they thought of what was going on. Thank you for bearing it. Thank you for being unflappable. And most importantly, thank you for writing such an honest reflection of the book. I really think it's an essential read. It adds to what is already an arsenal of reflections on what happened during that time. There are a number of students who were in it who have written extensively and deeply personally about what happened through it. I saw the fall, which went on to win awards all over the world, which was a dramatic representation of what was it like to be inside those rooms as students who were occupying Bremner House and the conversations that were taking place. That period in UCT that then spilled over to many universities across the country, I think, will prove an essential marker in our story of South Africa, because hopefully we get to learn what we need to learn going forward. And this book is an essential addition to that.